Hi, and welcome to lecture number 5 of the Introduction to C++ Game Programming, I suppose. We're going to start today with a few topics called functions, arrays, and Bresenham's line algorithm. This is lecture number 5. So we're going to start on slide number 3 with functions. So what is a function? Well, we're already used to functions in math. We can look at the familiar function on the page, f of x equals 5x plus 2. And notice that this function has an input, which is the variable x, and the input is displayed visually of f of x, meaning it's a function of, it depends on the variable x, and that's an input to the function. Finally, the function has an output. We input the variable x, and then we output a value. So if I write f of 5 somewhere on my paper, then this function will return 27. 5 times 5 is 25, plus 2 is 27. And this is sort of how functions work in C++ too. They have an input, and they have outputs. So let's look at slide number 4. So every function in C++ has an input, which is a variable or a constant value that you can put into the function, and it has an output, which is a variable that's returned from the function once it's finished processing. Back in slide number 3, whenever I write f of 5 anywhere on my paper, then you can always replace that f of 5 with 27, since that's always going to be what the function output is equal to. The same thing in C++. However, back on slide number 4, sometimes functions don't have inputs and outputs. And you've already seen this in the function int main. It's int main of void, and void means that it doesn't have an input. So when we look at that function that we've been using, int main of void, that means it doesn't have any inputs, but it does have some outputs. So why are functions important? If we look on slide number 5, it's important to write modular code. Modular just means that you can break down a program into lots of different modules. So you're taking a huge task, which is writing a game of Pong, and you're going to break it down into subtasks. Because honestly, writing a game of Pong sounds like something that's really tough to do. But we can break it down into different tasks, like, well, first of all, I need to draw the ball. So on page number 6 here, we just break it down into different tasks. We start off by initializing things. And then, here's our game loop. While we're flipping and it's running, then we're going to start off by getting the input, then we're going to draw all of our graphics, and then we're going to move the ball. And this is about as English-wise as C++ gets, because you can just read down that page exactly what's going on. It's all the parts of a game. You initialize it, you get the input, you render the graphics, and then you do your game logic, which is moving the ball around in this case. So, and you can further modularize this, like draw graphics. That seems like a pretty big task to me. So what if we wrote another function that was draw a ball, draw a paddle, draw the borders around the sides? So then we can further subdivide the draw graphics into draw ball, draw paddle, all of that stuff. And so that breaks down a huge sounding task into a really small task, or a lot of really small tasks. And we know how to do those small tasks. So that's really what programming big applications is all about, breaking them down into smaller subtasks that we know how to do. And sometimes the problem is trying to figure out exactly what the best way to break down a task is, especially if you have lots of different people working on the same product over the internet, for instance. It's really tough to figure out what's the best way to split this up so that everyone knows what they're doing and everyone has the vision of the completed product in their minds. And that's often the design, in the case of games, that's often the job of the design document, so that every single person on your team has the same vision of what the output will be. And also to modularize your game, to break it down into easy-to-do parts so that everyone knows what they're going to do and what's expected of them. So that's often, that's a really large goal of computer programming, to break things down into smaller tasks. So what you do a lot is modularization. So on page number 7, let's just take a look at a general function declaration or prototype here. We have the outputs, then we have the function name, and then we have the inputs. So one of the functions we're used to is the setPixel function. So I put the function declaration down there, and notice that before the setPixel part, which is supposed to be the output, we have that as void here. And before we said that void means that it doesn't have a return value. So our setPixel function isn't going to return anything to us, because all it does is set things on the screen. And that's not quite the same thing as what a return value is. So for parameters, things that we need to set the pixel on the screen are inputs. We need to know the X position, we need to know the Y position, and we need to know the color of the pixel. And it just so happens that all three of these are unsigned longs. So if we remember how we call the setPixel function, we usually put in a number, comma, a number, comma, sometimes another number. So we can either put in variables for these values, or we can just put in numbers. It doesn't matter, as long as we pass the setPixel function proper inputs that it can use to draw a pixel. And just as a note at the bottom, technically, a function that doesn't return anything is called a subroutine. So if you want to know all of your computer science lingo, functions usually do return things. And subroutines usually just draw something on the screen or do something without returning a value. So on to slide number 8. There are a few things that we need to do before we can start using a function. Now, I know that when you booted up the ITCC code with the framework, that you just started using functions. You just said ITCC setPixel, and you could immediately draw a pixel on the screen. But actually, a few things have to happen in the background to get a function like that working. So what we have to do is we have to declare a function, and then we have to define a function to get it to work. So first off, let's take a look at declaring a function. Well, we remember that before we could use a variable, we also had to declare that. And I don't think I ever explained really why we need to make a declaration of a variable. Well, that's a good question, which actually has a really good answer. We need to put a declaration of a variable in just to tell the compiler that we're going to use this variable later on in the code, and that it's a valid variable and that we meant to put it there. If we just start using variables all over the place, then it's tough to figure out when we should allocate memory for those variables. And it's also tough if we just sporadically put in variable names to figure out whether these are valid or whether the programmer even meant to put them there in the first place. So the same thing goes with a function. Further, what if the function body, all the code that references the function, is in a completely different place? Now remember that the compiler compiles a single file at a time. So if I reference a function like setPixel, if I just call it in one of my files, without a function declaration telling the compiler that this function is syntactically supposed to be like this, then I can write any function, I can call any function that I want to in that C++ file, and the compiler would never know whether I actually intended to put it there or not, because the code for the function is in a completely different place. So the declaration of the function just tells the compiler, this function exists somewhere else. I mean to use it in this file somewhere, and this is what it looks like. This is the proper syntactic representation of the function. So to declare a function, we just need to write a function prototype at the top of a source file. So at the bottom of slide 8 there, we can see void, say hi, void. And this is a function declaration. It just tells us that the say hi function won't have any return types, it won't return anything, and it's not going to have any value as an input, because both of them are void. And by also putting this function declaration on there, we're also saying that somewhere else in our code, we're going to show the compiler, what the code for this say hi function is. So you don't have to worry about that now, because it can be linked later on in the linking stage. And on slide number 9, what does the function body look like, or the function definition? The definition of something is where we actually define what the declaration is. So in the say hi function below, notice first of all that we added a parameter to the list. And a parameter is just one input. We inserted a color. So technically your function declaration needs to be the same as your function definition, but in this case they are different, and they really should be the same, or else your compiler will give you troubles saying that it can't find the function definition there, or declaration there, because you actually defined it in a different way than you declared it, which is bad. However, so in this case the input to our function is called highColor for some strange reason. And this is a parameter again. And notice that when we call the sayHi function, we can send it any value as a parameter that we want to. It can be any number from 0 to 4 billion some. So we need to make sure that in our sayHi function, we kind of generically generically hold this value somewhere, probably in a variable. So that variable in this case is high color. And whatever value that the user passes to the say hi function is going to be stored in high color. So no matter where in say hi we call or we use high color, that high color is going to have the value that the user passed to the function stored in it. So just as a quick example, that sounds like a lot. Let's look in at slide number 10 here for one more topic, I guess, before our example. Functions can also return values, and so far we've just been looking at void functions that don't return values. So let's look at a quick function here called addTo. So of course, I think that we all know how to add two numbers together, but we just have a function here to demonstrate how to add two numbers together using a function. So our addTo function is going to return a long, and it's going to take as input two longs, num1 and num2. Inside the function, note that we can declare variables anywhere in our program that we want to. But like we said in a few lectures ago, these variables have scope. So you see that we declare the long sum, sum being a variable, inside the addTo function. But since it's inside braces, once we exit this function, that memory is going to be deallocated, and the value that's stored in sum is going to be lost. Just as a quick note. So we notice that our addTo function takes two inputs, num1 and num2, and it returns a long value. And there's a special command in C++ and C called return, and that's why it's highlighted in blue there. So we can return any value that we want to back to the calling function. So in this case, we calculate the sum of num1 and num2, and we store that in variable sum. And that variable sum is only going to last for the duration of this function. It's going to be destroyed once we leave the function. So when we get down to that return statement, it's going to return the value of sum back to the caller, wherever we called the function. So sum is destroyed, but we actually pass the value that was in sum back to the caller. Something important to note, and that's going to frustrate you, I'm sure, is that functions can only return a single value. In this case, it can only return a long. However, there are things called structures and classes that we'll get into later that can actually hold lots of variables at once. And functions can actually return these. So that's how we get around this single variable problem. There's also another way of getting around it, but that involves pointers or references and things we won't get to for until next week at least. Now, the return statement, one more thing to note. Wherever you type in return inside a function, it's just going to return from the function. It's just going to leave the function. So just like in our main function, whenever we type in return, it's going to leave our program. Well, in this case, it's going to leave our function. So this has been a lot of words and no talk, so let's take a look at slide number 11 at a quick example. Here I wrote a quick power function. So it takes a number to a power. And it has three components to it. It has an input being a long. This is the declaration at the top here. And it has two inputs, a base and an exponent. So if you imagine 2 to the 5th power, then the base would be 2, and the exponent would be 5. And of course, that's equal to 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, which last time I checked was 32. 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. Yes, 32. So now let's look at our function definition, which is long power, long base comma long exponent. Notice that the definition is exactly the same as the declaration. And also notice that our function has a beginning brace and it has an ending brace. And everything within those braces will be executed when we call the function. So within our function power, you know, it's just like some normal code that we might write. We have the multiplication number, the number of times we've been through our multiplication, and we have a result, and I'm initializing that result to the value 1. And I'm inside the power function right now. So notice that since we declare the variables multnum and result inside the power function, inside this group of braces, once we leave these braces and return from the function, the variables multnum and result are going to be destroyed. And there's nothing we can do about that. They're going to be destroyed, and that's an important thing to remember, especially when we get into pointers and stuff next week. So next we have a for loop. If you remember how powers work, if I do 2 to the 5th power, that means to take the number 2 and multiply it by itself exponent number of times. So you take the number 2 and multiply by 2 5 times. So it's 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2. And that's what we're doing with this for loop here. We're starting the multiplication number at 0, and while this is less than the exponent, because the exponent is how many times we multiply it together, we just increment the multnum. Maybe I could have been a little more descriptive there. And then every time I multiply the result by the base. So I'm multiplying it by 2 5 times. And then again, we have that return function at the bottom there, where we return the result. So one thing we haven't looked at before is how do we call a function? So you'll notice our int main void function up there, and that's always the entry point of an application. So that's always where our program is going to start off. And this is a little confusing here. We call the power function, first off. Forget the equals and max number to the left. We call the power function with a value of 2, and then the variable numbits. So we can look up at the long, and we can see that numbits is equal to 10. So this is the same thing as calling the power function with a value of 2, comma, a value of 10. So the base is 2, and the exponent is 10. And so then the power function is going to compute that 2 to the 10th power is 1024, I believe. And it's going to return a value. Remember, because to the left of the power function, we have a long. And at the end of the power function, we return the result. And the result happens to be 1024. So one way of thinking about this is that this entire power function here, in the main function, wherever we call power, that's going to be replaced with the value 1024. So then we're left with the statement, max number equals 1024. So max number gets the value of 1024. And then after that, you can do whatever you want to do. And in this case, max number refers to, that's the maximum number you can store in a binary number that has 10 digits. Because 2 to the 10th value, I guess 9 digits, I'm sorry. That's right. If you have a binary value with a binary number with 9 digits, then 2 to the 10th is the maximum number of numbers you can store in it. So I guess maybe max number is a little misleading, I suppose. Because if you do 2 to the 10th power, then that's the number of numbers you can store in a 2 to the 9th power, because you go from 0 to the max number. But that's from lecture number 2. So just to recap really fast, we have the declaration of our function power, and that defines the inputs to our function, base and exponent, and it defines the return value, which is going to be a long. So whenever we terminate the function power, we're going to return a value, and that value is going to replace the entire power function whenever we call that function. So if we look in the main function, int main void, then we're going to notice that we call the function power. And right when we get to the function power in the code, we need to jump down to our power function. So now when we jump down to the power function, base is equal to 2 and exponent is equal to whatever is stored in numbits, in this case 10. So we start our power function with base equal to 2 and exponent equal to 10. We compute the power, which is 1024, and then we return the result, which is 1024. So back in the main function, we're going to replace the entire power, parenthesis 2 comma numbits, parenthesis, with 1024. So then max number is going to be set equal to 1024. Does that make sense to everyone? Hopefully it does. On slide number 12, one of the most popular functions that we've seen before is int main void. And before, we didn't really explain why we put in that int main void thing into every single program. And that we learned that was just the entry point to our application. That's where we'd start executing code once our program started. So our beloved main is a function. So it's going to return an integer value to the operating system, which tells whether the function was terminated correctly or not. And we notice that we have a void in the parameter list there, or in the inputs, and that void is telling us that our main function doesn't accept any inputs. However, if you look online, there actually is a version of the main function that accepts inputs. And these inputs would arise, for example, if you were in the command line and you call the function, like back in the DOS days, if you call a program, then you can type in the program and then you can type in some parameters you want to pass to the program. And even in Windows you can do this, actually. You can specify parameters that you pass to your program when you call it. And in that case, you can replace void with something that's already defined, pointers basically, to variables that are set there when you call your program. But only look into that if you're interested. I guess in Windows it isn't really needed anymore, although it is used. Okay, to slide number 13, we're going to start off with arrays, and I wish I could have gone over this a little better in my slides, but I'm not the best artist, and it takes a while to make art, so hopefully if you have more questions about arrays, feel free to ask them, or functions, by the way, feel free to ask them in the forums, look for them online. There are a bunch of things on these topics online. So, why would we want to use arrays? What is an array? So sometimes, I'm sure you've imagined, in Pong, what if you wanted to add 2 balls? What if you wanted to add 5 balls? What if you wanted to add 100 balls to the screen? Well, that would be awfully tedious, because you'd have to add a bunch of variables, a bunch of positions, a bunch of velocities for every single ball. And that would take forever. And you'd have to add all the logic in for every single ball. And that's one reason that we did Pong for the first game, because it's very simple, and it only has 2 paddles and a ball. It doesn't have 10 balls. So we got a question, what is the data type MyArray? And we actually aren't there yet. So we're getting there. We're still on slide 13. So we decided on slide 13 that let's say we want 20 balls on the screen. Well, maybe instead of using all these singular variables, we can use something called arrays. And an array is a bunch of the same variable allocated right after each other. So that sounds pretty confusing. So let's look at slide 14. There's a diagram at the bottom, and the declaration for an array is also stored on page 14. We have long myArray, then 5. So let's see if we can decompose this. Whenever we call long myArray without the 5, then we're going to allocate 32 bits of memory that we can use. So on that diagram at the bottom of the screen, that would be the same as block 0 there. So without any of the other blocks. So we'd have the variable myArray, which is in the box up there. I should have drawn an arrow or something. We have a box myArray, and that's pointing sort of to the first block of 32 bits there. So whenever I use myArray, I'm referring to that first block there, and that's 32 bits. However, if I use an array like this, then I can say long myArray, bracket 5, end bracket. And that's going to allocate 5 blocks of memory. 5 blocks of 32 bits contiguously. And contiguous just means right after each other. So instead of only allocating that first block of memory in the bottom diagram, I'm going to allocate a big chunk of memory, or 5 32-bit values that are right after each other. So I just allocated 10 bytes of memory. What am I saying? 20 bytes of memory. Because there are 8 bits in a byte, and I just allocated 5 blocks of 2 bytes, which is 10 bytes. So we just allocated 5 blocks of 32 bits. So someone just said that long is a data type. Yeah, long's a data type. Yeah, long is a long integer. And a long integer is declared as 32 bits. So remember, we have short integers, and those are 16 bits. And then we have long integers, and those are 32 bits. So a long is 32 bits on 16-bit systems. Long is the same as long int. It's just an abbreviation, so that we don't have to type out long int. If we used an int for myArray, then that would also allocate 5 blocks of 32 bits. But remember that an integer is based on the bitage of your microprocessor. So in this case, we're probably using 32-bit microprocessors. So an integer is 32 bits long. When we switch over to 64-bit processors in a few years, then an integer is going to be 64 bits. But in this case, we just reserved five contiguous blocks of memory right after each other in memory. So that's slide 14. So keeping this in mind, when we can go to slide 15. Now, we can access any one of these five blocks of memory by using an index. So if I call my array 2 equals the value 5, then we can look back at our five-value array, and we go to the third memory block, or index 2, because the first index is number 0. The second index is number 1, because in computer science we always start out counting with a 0. So when I say that my array 2 is equal to the value 5, then I'm actually going to the second block here on slide 14, and I'm placing a number 5 into it. And there might be anything else in array in the other four blocks. But in this case, I'm just putting the number 5 into the third block from the third block from the left here. So we just set that third element equal to 5, and now we can access that element in the exact way that we set it. We can say, if the third element from the right is equal to 5, then we're going to do something. And notice that this is used exactly how any other variable that you've ever used is. You just have a number in there now. My array with a number. My array 2. So that just means that you're referring to a certain element of the array. So if we go to slide 16, here's another way to look at it. Here I'm allocating 10 blocks of memory that are right after each other in memory, and they're all 32 bits, and in this case I'm initializing them to certain values. I'm initializing the first block to 0, the second block to 1, the third to 2, and so on and so forth, till I initialize the 10th block to the number 9. And this is a really fast and convenient way of initializing arrays. However, you can only initialize an array like this when you declare the array. You can't put this equal sign into your code anywhere. You can only use the equal sign like this with the braces to the right. You can only use the braces like this when you declare the variable. So make sure you put in what you want when you initialize it like that, when you declare it. Now, if you forget how to do that, or if you want to, for example, clear your array all to zeros, then the way we'd have to do this later on in our code is with a for loop. And with this for loop, I's starting at the value 0, and I's going from 0 to 9. And every increment through the loop, I's being incremented by 1. So the first time through the loop, we say x position of index 0 is equal to 0. And then the second time, I is equal to 1, so the second x position is equal to 0. Then the next time, I is equal to 2, so the third x position is equal to 0. And so on and so forth until we've cleared our entire array called xpos to zeros. So this is kind of, this little initialization thing is a pretty important thing in the array world. Just so you know how to clear an entire array at once. That's a pretty cool thing to do. So on slide number 17, if I haven't convinced you enough, what are arrays useful for? What if we want to make an explosion on the screen? Well, that's an awful lot of little points to keep track of. And it might be helpful, since they all behave in the same way, to store all those pixel values in an array right after each other. Or what if you have lots of enemies on the screen that you need to keep track of? What if they're all parachuting down at you? Well, it's going to be really inconvenient to write separate logic for every single paratrooper. it's much easier just to write logic for a single generic paratrooper, and then to use that logic for every single one. So you can just increment through the arrays, and that'll go from the first paratrooper to the last paratrooper, and apply the same logic to them all, with just a single for loop. So this ability to loop through an array is what makes arrays so powerful. If the values being stored are kind of the same, and even if they kind of aren't, it makes sense to compactly store them like that, because there are lots of times, like in databases and games and virtually everything you think of, even in this IRC channel, you probably have an array that's holding all the names of the people in there, because you can treat all of the names as about the same. So that's just a really neat thing that you'll probably take care of. And Slavik made a point on the IRC channel that the main returns a value to its caller, which is not necessarily the operating system. And that's true, because you don't always run a program from the operating system. One program might run another program, and that would return a value. So that's definitely true. So, slide 18, how are we going to pass an array to a function? This is something that's kind of tricky and that sets some people on edge. And I only allocated one slide to it here. So let's take a look at this. Whenever we pass a value to a function, then we never have to specify. I'm sorry, whenever we pass an array to a function, if it's a singly dimensioned array, if there's only one dimension to the array, then we don't have to specify how many elements are in the array. So when we have draw enemies, this is used to our advantage. When we have draw enemies, we pass it the x positions of the enemies, the y positions of the enemies, and then the number of enemies there are. And then inside the draw enemies function, we might loop through numEnemies, assuming that the x and y arrays both contain numEnemies enemies, or numEnemies positions. We're going to loop through that, and we can look inside the x and y arrays and draw all the enemies appropriately. So that is basically how you can pass arrays to functions. So, if I were going to actually call that, there's a little code fragment below. Really easy thing to do. Just remember to leave off the brackets when you pass them to draw enemies. Because whenever you put a bracket on, if you put xpos bracket 0, then that's going to imply the value that's stored at position 0 in the array. That's not going to represent the entire array anymore. Moving on to slide 19, this is a really brief look at multi-dimensional arrays, but you can think of a two-dimensional array, not a multi-dimensional array, this is two-dimensional, as having a width and a height, or columns and rows. So before we just had one row and a lot of columns, and now we have a lot of rows and a lot of columns. So we have a two-dimensional grid, and already you're probably thinking this might be good for a map editor. So on slide number 20, while we might conceptually think of a two-dimensional array as being two-dimensional, it isn't two-dimensional. All of the values in the array are right after each other. They're contiguous in memory. So the computer actually uses a little formula to calculate where you are in the array. And maybe I should have written that formula down, because that's pretty useful to linearize a two-dimensional array, as they call it. Because you'll be using that in your setPixel function, actually. So, how would we declare the two-dimensional array above? Well, the fact is that I put long my array 4, 5. And then I said that allocates the previous memory in the last slide with 4 rows and 5 columns. But the fact is, you can think of it any way that you want to. You can say arbitrarily that the first one is 4 columns and the second number is 4 rows or 5 rows, but I mean, any way you want to think of it is fine. I use this convention since that's often used with matrices, and I'm kind of mathy guy. So if we take a look at how we access it below, then my array 2, 1, using my convention, would refer to the square that's marked with a 2 in the y direction, in the so the third row down, and it would refer to the second row across. So we find out where those two, that column and row, intersect, and that's the value we're going to take. So, you know, if you're thinking about making a map, a level editor, or if you have a table of values, like maybe you're looking at a table of x and y position versus time or something, and on one axis you might have the values of the x's, and on the other you might have values of time, and you can see what the y output would be or something like that. And we are asked how many dimensions are allowed in C or C++ for an array. And I think that it depends on the compiler you're using. I've heard it gets up into hundreds of thousands, but I'm not sure what the exact number is. I think it is dependent on I think it is dependent on the compiler. So if we want to add a third dimension to the array, one way of visualizing it is as a cube. You can go toward an x, y, and z position and get the value in that cell. If you go to four dimensions, you know, that you could think of that as a hypercube, but that's almost unthinkable because we have no idea what that looks like. So, I mean, you can think of it however you want to. Most people never use anything beyond two-dimensional arrays. So if you know how to do two-dimensional arrays, I'd say you're safe. Just as an example, on slide number 21, I know I'm not really going through this very well, but let's say I wanted to store a list of polygon points. Well, I have an array called polypoints, and I have three sets of two, which are stored in my polypoints array. And this is just one way of thinking about it. I'm just saying these are x, y, so these are just points on the screen. So here's how I'd initialize a multidimensional array. I should have made a whole other slide on this, but here's how you initialize a multidimensional array: 5, 2, 2, 1, 5, 3. And remember, you can't set this equal anywhere else in your program. And then, just as a quick example of how we'd initialize all these points, if we didn't do it at the very top, we need two for loops this time, where x is my column and y is my row. So I'm going to say polypoints y x, using my convention again, is equal to 0. So that sets all the values in my two-dimensional array equal to 0. So you'll have to take a look at that. Maybe look at some other references on the web, or ask some questions, because that's kind of confusing. And as a final note on this topic, when you pass in a two-dimensional array to a function, then you have to tell the function how many elements are in one of the two parts of the array. Usually the first one, that's closest to the name. So if I was passing polypoints to a function, then I have to specify that one of them holds three elements, or the other dimension holds two elements. That's something I have to tell the function, because otherwise the compiler can't precisely calculate the position you would be in the array. So maybe I'll try to explain this more clearly next lecture, but the compiler has to linearize. Okay, remember, all the memory is stored contiguously, whether it's a two-dimensional array, a one-dimensional array, whatever. And in the two-dimensional case, if I don't pass it one of the two numbers, then it doesn't know how far to step forward every time. I mean, if I don't give it anything, if I don't tell it how big one of the dimensions is, it has no idea how wide I want my rectangle. So it doesn't know how many squares to skip forward when I access something. So since that's problematic, you need to usually send the leftmost bracketed number to a function when you declare it. And Xylo asked, if you pass arrays to a function, is it by reference like in Java? And it is by reference. You're actually passing a pointer to the function. So you always pass a 32-bit value to your function. You never pass the entire array. And it isn't really called... I mean, when you say value, you're sending the contents of what's stored in the variable. And when you pass an array to a function, you're not passing the contents of the array. You're passing a pointer to the contents of the array. So that's always a 32-bit value. So, and we're saying that an address is also a value, but it's not the value that's stored in the address. So a lot of people call this passing by address. So you're not sending... you're not sending all the values that are stored in the array, but you're sending the address of the array so that we can find these values. So that would probably be passing by address. And there's actually something in C++ called passing by reference. And that's a little different than passing by address. But we're going to get to that later. So that's all I had on arrays and all I had on all of that stuff, arrays and functions. But we can look really quickly at some of the Bresenham's material. So I'm going to post the link to the Bresenham websites in the chat room here. And I posted that in the homework here, so let me go to the homework. And we're going to take a look at some of the Bresenham line algorithm slides. And it helps a lot to see pictures of these, how they work through pictures. So I'm going to take the second link first and paste it into the chat room. Because this is a pretty good link, I think. So when we first start thinking about lines, then what immediately comes to our heads is called the digital difference algorithm, or DDA. And believe it or not, if you guys have had basic algebra, y equals mx plus b, then you already know how to apply the digital difference algorithm. And in fact, it's probably the first thing you'll think of when you think of drawing a line to a screen. So all we do with the digital difference algorithm is, well, let's take a look at the first code segment on the site. Well, you already see that familiar form you're used to, y equals mx plus b. So y1 equals k times x1 plus b. And we know that we can calculate the slope from any two given points, right? So the slope is rise over run. So if you look at what k is equal to the rise, which is the difference in the y values, over the run, which is the difference in the x values. And then we have our y-intercept, which is what b is, right? So b is our y-intercept, and we can calculate that from two points. Notice this is just the rearrangement of y equals mx plus b. We just rearranged it to solve for b. And so if we look at the algorithm, which is the second code fragment, this is exactly what you'd probably do if you thought of, you know, how would I draw a line? Well, I'd calculate what the slope is of the line and what the y-intercept of the line is. And that's what they're doing there in calculating k and b. K is the slope and b is the y-intercept. And then all they're doing is... it looks like they have an error there. But all they're doing is they're going pixel by pixel, x value by x value, because every time you increment an x value, that's a new pixel, and they're calculating what the y value is for that x value. And then they're just putting a pixel there. Notice that they're using some casting. Notice that the variable y is a float. We haven't talked about floats, but a float is a floating point number, and it has a decimal. They're calculating y as a float with a decimal, and then in their put pixel routine, they're converting that to an integer. So they're just truncating the decimal when they're converting it. So they're applying it at the x, and if you notice here, they're not really doing it correctly. That's not really a good way to phrase it, I don't think. But they're stepping through it x by x. They're starting at x1 and they're going to x2 is basically what they're doing. Assuming that x1 is less than x2. They're just going from x1 to x2. And every time they're computing what the y value is, and then they're just putting a pixel there. Exactly what you learned in math class with that y equals mx plus b algorithm. So that's the digital difference algorithm. It has a complicated name, but it's exactly what we do to start out with. You know, that's how we'd solve the problem. So if you don't know how to implement Bresenhams, you know, this is an easy way to go, and it'll draw a fairly good result. So with Bresenhams, you know, actually it's based on the same concept. And let's back out of this one and go to the first link here I'll give you. This is probably the best article on the subject I could find on the internet. And the key behind Bresenhams is that we aren't using any floating point numbers. And that was important because, well, before we had the 386 processors, we couldn't do floating point on a computer. There wasn't any hardware to do it, so we had to make up something that wasn't floating point, but was called fixed point, and that's what most people used. But it wasn't supported by the processor. But starting with the 386, they had add-on floating point processors that you could buy. And now with the Pentiums, of course, the floating point processors are integrated in with the regular processor. So you actually have like dual processor systems, because the floating point processor can act in parallel with your normal processor. But the point is, in today's world, floating point is computed almost as fast or faster than integer. But Bresenhams is still a very popular line drawing algorithm. And this article doesn't really have any pictures in it, unfortunately, but there's a table in it that gives 2, 4, 6, 8 different cases that our line could be in. And let's see. If you look at the upper left-hand case, this is kind of in purple, I guess, or light blue. The upper left-hand case is where the line is increasing to, it's going up and to the right, and it's going faster in the x direction than it is in the y. So it's moving to the right faster than it is going up. And if you take a look at that code, all that is the y equals mx plus b function yet again. Notice that this for statement is correct this time, but the for statement again, we're going from the first x value, x1, and we're proceeding to the second x value, x2. And we can do this because we know that we're going to the right and increasing in value. So we can start at x1 and just go to x2. And we know every time we increment x, that's a new value. That's a new pixel that we need to plot. So we're just going to put that pixel at x, y. And we know, for starters, that our first y value is y1, because we're going to illuminate the pixel, the first pixel that we're going to draw. So up at the top there, y equals y1. And every time through the for loop, we're going to increment y by delta y. And in this case, delta y is the slope of our line. So every single time we increment x, we're going to increment the y by the slope of our line. And so again, you know, this is just a hidden application of y equals mx plus b. just how all of the line algorithms are. So that's basically how one of these cases works. And the if statement there is sort of a check to figure out whether we need to go up a little in the y direction. You see, we know that our x direction is moving, our x value is moving a lot faster than our y value, because the absolute value of delta x is greater than the absolute value of delta y. So we know that we'll be moving our y up in slow increments. So basically, if we move our x up by 1, then the y is always going to move up less than that. So there's going to come a point when we move the y up 1 pixel, and 1 pixel alone, since our increment in the x direction is only 1 pixel, right? So if the x is moving a lot faster than the y, then if we move the x up by 1, then the y moves up by less than 1. And eventually, that less than 1 is going to escalate into moving up a single pixel. And that's what that if statement does. But at no point are we ever going to increment the y more than 1 pixel, since the x is going faster than the y. And if you can derive that little y equals mx plus b thing again for each of these 8 cases, and then if you study these, you'll find a lot of patterns, and you can put all those patterns together in the algorithm, which is below. And it looks really complicated, but it isn't. It's just y equals mx plus b. And if you understand all these cases up here, the 8 different cases, and then you look for patterns and you try to match it to what's actually in Bresenham's line algorithm down here, you'll find that all it is y equals mx plus b, and that you already have all the math and the knowledge in the world that you need to draw a line using Bresenham's line algorithm. And that's really cool, because Bresenham's is one of the leading line algorithms. Now, there have been a lot of papers published to try to make it faster and to try to draw runs of pixels at once and all this other stuff, but if you understand this algorithm, that's going pretty far. And so that's probably all I'm going to say about that. If you look at the other two links on the Homework 3 site, then they also describe Bresenham's circle algorithm. And of course, there are other ways of drawing circles. The circles is a little more tricky, though. So if you want to, you know, if it's a little tricky, and there aren't as good explanations on the web. But really quickly, Bresenham's algorithm relies on the fact that a circle is symmetric. So really, all you have to do is calculate the points in the upper right-hand quadrant, the first quadrant, and then just reflect them across different lines, and then you make a circle. So that decreases your computation time by a lot. So it would be pretty cool if you could draw a circle in there too. But those are the three pages that I put there. And you can also look online and find a lot of other Bresenham resources. He's a pretty popular guy. So just briefly to mention the homework, I'm going to post it tonight or tomorrow, but I'm going to move up the deadline too, since I'm posting it so late, because I have to actually write a lot of code too for this one. For challenge one, what we're going to do here with our new knowledge of functions is to try to build up a library of routines to help us out with making our games. Because, you know, right now it's kind of lengthy to make all this Pong stuff. Like, for the paddles and for the ball, wouldn't it have been a lot easier if I could just call a rectangle function and had it draw a rectangle for me for those, instead of actually writing out all the for loops? Or, you know, if I could just draw a line on the screen, you know, I could make anything. I could make a little swinging pendulum. The line is what's needed even to draw polygons on the screen. So if I want to make a 3D render or something, or a 3D engine, I need to be able to draw lines and polygons. The line is one of the most basic primitives I can make. So we need to get a line algorithm working here. And a circle one isn't really that necessary, but it's pretty cool. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to make a library of routines. And before, we had the clear routine and we had the set pixel routine in the framework. But the deal is that now you can write those yourself. Almost. You should have a little more knowledge of pointers. So we'll see what happens when I post the homework. But, you know, with using for loops, you can write your own clear that clears the screen. And the setPixel algorithm might give you a pointer or the beginning of an array to the start of video memory, and you can actually write that out yourself. For challenge number two, we're going to try to do something with all these functions that we've created, this library. So how about we make a screensaver in the style of Windows Mistify? And Mistify is a screensaver where a bunch of lines bounce around the screen. And the cool thing is that you already know everything there is to know about things bouncing around the screen at 45 degree angles. And this screensaver thing is just an extension of that, except you'll have to use a few arrays since there are bunches of points, and it is a little more complicated. Or actually, it isn't more complicated, it's just a little different. As long as you've got that bouncing, though, you've got it made. And finally, something I didn't go over is the random function, R-A-N-D. And I gave a really brief tutorial on that. Not a tutorial, but a few statements in the homework. So, if you want more on that, just do a Google search. Rand is one of the most popular things for making random points. So you'll find lots of stuff on that online. So, I'll post the download stuff tonight or tomorrow, and I think that will conclude this lecture. So thanks a lot for coming, and I'll stay around for questions.